I am delighted today that our guest is Nancy J. Adler. We're going to talk about how Nancy has worked with managers from around the world to create synergy among cultures rather than building walls to keep out differences. Let's start with who gets to lead today.
Well, a lot of people think that leadership has to do with a title. Those are the people who get to lead. But in fact, leadership is a verb. It's leading. And it means that all of us every day are called to lead. The only place, though, that we can lead is from where we stand. So I do lead as a professor, as a speaker, as a writer, as an artist. But I can't lead as a president or a head of an organization because that's not who I am. I teach leadership. I hold seminars with managers and executives on leadership. And I was watching the evening news, and I often flip from channel to channel to channel to get different perspective. And I happened to have turned on MSNBC. And Rachel Maddow was explaining what was going on in the U.S., some of the dynamics of what was going on in the U.S. She was interviewing a group of people in Virginia who were having trouble getting in to see their congressman. And they called, and they knocked on the door, and he wouldn't see them. And they had very concrete things that they wanted to tell him and that they wanted him to do. So as she tells the story, they went off to a pizza parlor, the best pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. They had them bake a delicious pizza. They put their statement inside the pizza box. They had the pizza delivered to the congressman's office. Oh, by the way, they also had the press there, of course, while they were watching. And as soon as that great aroma wafted in, the congressman opened the door and the message was delivered.
That's a brilliant approach.
I thought it was completely creative. I thought it was brilliant. But I also realized in that moment that Rachel Maddow was being a leader and teaching leadership from where she sat. And where she sits is as an anchor on a news program. Mm-hmm. So she was talking to all of us about, okay, you're blocked, get creative, come up with an innovative thing. If you purpose, if you really believe in what you're trying to get done, the fact that a congressman won't answer the phone or open the door isn't going to stop you. It's just going to get you creative. They acted from where they stood, and she was acting. She was probably acting as a more powerful leadership professor than many of us in my field.
And many people heard and hopefully took action based on that.
Right. Not that pizza parlors had a big uptick, but that people realized that they could get what they wanted done. They just had to do it using a very different process and vocabulary than they'd ever considered before.
One of the things I talk about is influence and choice. We have choices, and a lot of things are hard to accomplish. But the creativity, and as an artist, you're using creativity in different mediums. You talked about the Leading Beautifully Award. So in your Lifetime Achievement acknowledgement, you gave the International Leadership Association an award. I think that exemplifies much of what you're trying to say here.
The Leading Beautifully Award, which a number of organizations have asked me to create for them to honor the whole organization or a team or an individual within their organization, is based on the idea that we need to be inspired to reach the kind of society we really want. So if you're awarding something to any organization, it can't be like the typical award where you look at what you've done in the past and in the present, you say, hey, thanks for having done that. It has to be based on what you've done before, but then it has to say, based on the best of who you've been, what's the absolute best that you can do in the future and that we need you to do in the future? Mm-hmm. If I just say that, people sort of roll their eyes and say, yes, that would be nice if we did that. So then I realized that the way I could say that was by using art, in this case, a ceramic bowl, as a mirror for them to be able to see themselves. So I created a bowl. I wish this wasn't just a podcast so I could let everybody see the bowl. And I asked people first to start by looking at the glazes that were all swirling around and running on, and to notice that as soon as one glaze touches another glaze, it's transformed, but it's transformed into something beautiful that could not happen if there was just one glaze.
And that's the metaphor for how we interact, even the interactions that we find unpleasant.
Exactly, exactly. So part of those contrasts is what brings out definition and allows us to understand what our unique contribution is that's completely different. But it also explicitly honors diversity. We can't have that whole beautiful surface without having all those different colors, all those different contrasts, all those different perspectives coming in.
Bumping into each other.
In this case, the pot was fired at 2,300 degrees. You don't know ahead of time, but you have to trust that what's going to happen. And similarly, when I think about ILA, but also a lot of other organizations today, they talk about being inclusive and they talk about being innovative. When I was creating the bowl for ILA, the award bowl, I knew that one, its base had to be very strong. So whatever hit it, it would stay solid and sitting there. But it also had to be flared wide open so that it would be inviting to whether clients or partners or government agencies you're working with or new ideas. It had to be open. In order for a bowl, a ceramic bowl, to be open, you're sitting on the wheel and you're throwing the bowl. And then, as you might guess, you're little by little bending the top of it out. So it gets, as you do that, you risk it collapsing.
We talk about inclusion, and too much, we risk collapsing our culture.
Exactly. Or if we don't take the time to support who we're welcoming in, so we are afraid of them rather than seeing how they could uniquely contribute. If the bowl collapses on the wheel, the same question has to be asked that we ask ourselves as leaders, which is to remember that we know from the research, extraordinary leaders and extraordinary artists risk more and more often. They fail more often than do ordinary people and ordinary leaders. But that's the only way you get beyond yourself. So if this bowl collapses, then what do I need to do as an artist? I need to return to the wheel and I need to throw another better bowl. Bowl I created for ILA was not my first bowl.
How many?
I won't remember that.
So it was more than two.
It's interesting because one of the leaders who was president at ILA asked me if this wasn't just like a typical innovation process where iteratively you add a little, add a little, add a little. And I had to say that no, it isn't. This is, you tried it, you pushed it out as absolutely wide open as you could, and it didn't add a little, it failed. It was a pile of gooey clay. It wasn't a bowl, okay?
Which is how some of us feel when we fail.
Right. And when a team has tried really hard and you either don't get the client, they should try the new software and it just doesn't work. But then the question is, okay, I remember that part of great leadership is to risk more often, know that you're going to fail more often, and go back to the wheel. There's one other piece to it, though. If you look at great leaders, they don't repeat the same mistake twice. They learn from their first mistake, and they may make another mistake and it may fail again, but they've made a different mistake. It's a constant learning curve.
Well, the other is often they don't blow up the enterprise. I'm learning and growing and making lots of mistakes all the time. And with each one, hopefully I'm course correcting. I think that's an important distinction. As people hear, I fail, it doesn't mean my business collapses.
And the analogy is, I didn't blow up the pottery studio.
Right, you blew up the bowl.
I had one bowl, big deal. Get back on the wheel, throw another bowl. If I had been conservative, not in the political sense, but in the literal sense.
In the bowl making
sense. In the bowl making sense, okay? In the same way, in the team building sense, I would have thrown a ball that didn't flare out. So didn't risk. But that isn't what I'm trying to do. That is the organization that's trying to heal kids who have a disease that currently we don't know how to deal with isn't going to say, well, I'm going to go back and deal with the flu. No. And one other piece with that. What supports us in taking those big risks? What supports us when we fail and are hugely disappointed and often a little embarrassed by the fact that it didn't work, to get back in there and return to the team or return to the wheel? And the answer to that question is always purpose. What we're trying to do, have those kids be healthy, not living in the hospital, have the community have clean water, have the company succeed so that it can share its product or service with the broader world. Mm-hmm. Whatever is the purpose, unless there's a purpose that's profoundly important to you as a human being, I guarantee you, you will not continue to take the big risk. You will not learn what you need to learn. You will not take the next big risk and, oh my goodness, have the potential of failing twice or three times in a row.
And have the capacity to fail twice or three times in a row. Because it's the purpose that gives us the capacity.
Right. And you're smart about it. You don't risk the whole organization. Because you care so much about outcome, we need peace in this region. We need containers that carry water that don't pollute the oceans and the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, we need fabrics made out of bamboo that's a rapidly growing, or, you know, I don't care what it is, and it's different things that are important to different people. But if you don't have that sense that you're contributing something that's really of value, you're not going to take the risk, and you're not going to lead, and you're going to disappear into old structures. But it's even worse than that. Because we all know that with the rate of change, and especially discontinuous change, even if I try and be conservative and safe, and I do what worked yesterday and the week before and the year before, it's not going to work anymore.
I think that is such a critical point, that old phrase, doing what got you here won't get you there.
Yeah, Marshall Goldsmith.
Because of the rate of change, I become obsolete. As a leader, I will do damage to my organization because I have not grown.
Exactly. And if you look at the world right now, it used to be, especially for people in the privileged economy, U.S. developed economy, huge economy, Canada developed economy, not as big as the U.S., European Union, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We could kind of look around and say, as long as I'm the best organization here, in my country, that's good enough. Well, today, the only question you can ask is, are we the best in the world, and are we on a path to stay the best in the world?
Am I on a path to stay is really an important question. And don't underestimate the rate of change. It's accelerating in a way I think none of us understand yet.
And the desire of people all over the world to contribute. And increasingly, their access to ways to get educated and contribute. So if you think just of the innovation of the online courses with Coursera and the various other company, now people, no matter how rural an area you're in, you now have access, think about management, to the top Stanford professors, the top Wharton professors. Wharton put its entire first-year program online. If everybody knows that, that's my baseline. But I really have to ask, what's the unique contribution that I can make that nobody else in this world can make while being excellent?
This podcast, as an example, is available globally. It's free. There are opportunities to learn and grow and expand as long as I have a computer or an iPhone or some device that will allow me to stream information. So to your point, each of us has a purpose and a way to contribute to the world. And in an environment where we're changing so quickly, we're all required as the pieces of the puzzle to move our societies forward.
Right. And as a piece of that, with the question of what does it mean to lead for all of us, right, from wherever we stand. What it means to lead today for any of us, if we bring together the question of why am I doing this? How can I do it with excellence? And how can I do it world class, no matter where I'm sitting?
And that means not just people with PhDs. That means people with no education can still be world class in their contribution to the world.
Even more so today, because the best people in education are rethinking what education means. Mm-hmm. Because the vast amount of, one, knowledge is, the production of knowledge is, has gone off the ceiling, but two, almost all concrete knowledge for a professional degree will be obsolete by the time you graduate. So memorizing it, which was a lot of education and working, getting the big, it is a passé concept. The question is, can we listen to what's going on in the world? Can we see what's going on in the world? Not the prior leadership question, what do I do, what do I say to the people in my organization? As things get more complex, as they change faster, as more of those changes are discontinuous, then the question is the anthropologist's question and the artist's question of, can I see what's actually going on? And then once I can see that which I never imagined before, I can begin to come up with a strategy. And so one of the things I found that's really helpful with art is I oftentimes ask people to choose a painting and then to just look at it for 3 minutes. I take out my iPhone and I time them. And I warn them, for those who don't meditate, it's going to feel like a long time. And sure enough, I start seeing people, you know, looking off to them, and I'm sad. And I ask them what it was like to still their life, like a painting is still life, to still their life back down, and then what it was like to give that quality of attention to the painting, how the painting changed, what they saw that was different. And of course, they saw all sorts of things more in the end of the first minute, the end of the second minute, the third minute. I then ask them, what in their life deserves the quality of attention they just gave to this? And 3 minutes is huge, because we don't, I mean, the average person goes to the Louvre to look at the Mona Lisa and spends 30 seconds.
Are you serious?
After having waited in line to get there. We've lost the ability to see, and if we don't see, we can't act on the world, because we're assuming it was the way it was yesterday or last year or last month, and it's no longer that way. I ask them what in their work, in their organization, deserves the quality of attention they just gave to that painting. And I ask them, and I ask myself, what in the world deserves the quality of that attention? You ask me, is it only PhDs who can lead, or only people who have advanced degrees and MBAs? Perhaps that used to be more helpful than it is today, because things are changing so fast that if I'm an expert in something that's mostly become obsolete, I'm not going to be any better than you if I have a PhD in it. Where I will outperform you is if I can ask questions better, if I can outlearn you, if I can see, and if I can listen. You know, so we work with music, we work with art to re-give people the ability to see, the ability to hear, and then the ability to ask questions.
Can you give an example of how using art helps make a difference in how we pay attention?
There are lots of examples, but I think one of the most profound ones was an experiment first conducted at Yale Medical School. And they had very well conducted research. They had their first-year medical students, half of them, take an art history course. So not a studio course. They weren't painting. They weren't drawing. Just art history. Look at paintings. Come to understand paintings. And all the rest of the training was exactly the same. When the students, the young medical students, started to go on rounds, and the physician leading the rounds would explain what was going on with a particular patient, and then they would come back the next week, and the patient wasn't doing very well. And they would ask the students, what did they think was going on? And from the non-arts trained students, you disproportionately got the response that, well, maybe the patient wasn't following the treatment regime correctly, or maybe they needed a higher dose of the medications. But basically, that you needed to do more of what you had already started and make sure that it was happening. When they did exactly the same, and they were using the same patients and so same conditions, they brought in the students who had taken the art history class, way disproportionately, they said, well, wait a sec, is our diagnosis right? Are we treating the right disease? Why did you think that? And what would you think it would be the doctor's question. And they begin to ask questions about, you know, what their skin color was like and what the, you know, all different aspects of the person. After they watched that pattern repeat itself and repeat itself, and in almost all cases, the arts-trained students were better diagnosticians than were the non-arts. As they began to look, those art history-taking students noticed way more about what was going on. They saw more of what was going on with the patient. They saw things that the others hadn't seen, and they were much less likely to jump to the conclusion that their first diagnosis, their first guess, had been right. Now, why might that be true? Think of a painting. Think of the last time you looked at a painting. Okay? Paintings can be interpreted in all different ways. You can look at the texture, you can look at the colors, you can look if there's a narrative, if there's a story underneath it, you can look if it's a part of a particular tradition, you can look at, and there is generally no right answer. There are multiple interpretations. So what the students had done implicitly, because at the beginning of this, nobody knew what was going on, is they took that into their practice of medicine. And they saw, they observed way more. They didn't just look at the portrait in the middle of the painting. They looked at the background. They looked at the frame. They looked at everything that was going on. They were so surprised, because to get that kind of difference in social science research is very unusual. So they replicated and they replicated. There are now over 20 schools, top medical schools, in the U.S. and outside the U.S. that are using some form of that process. And what they're doing is they're both giving people the ability to see and take in much more data before they condense it into what's the pattern here. And so that they can, in fact, question themselves about what their first diagnosis or their first guess was. Diagnostics are important for every profession. If we're managers, what's going on with this company? What data are we looking at? If we're just looking domestically, we might miss internationally. If we're just looking inside of our own industry, we may look totally miss a threat or an opportunity that's coming in from a totally different industry. If we're just looking within our best technology, we're not able to see what could come from someplace else. And so part of my reaction to hearing that research was to say, let's make this easier for managers. And so I created my two sides, my leadership side and my artist side. I created a leadership insight journal that has 27 paintings in it. It's got lots of blank pages in it.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
And it invites very busy managers and executives to take a step back and ask, what's going on here? What's important? What am I seeing? It invites them to take a step back from being in the middle of the fray to see with different eyes And the art helps them to do that. The blank pages, their quotes from other managers and people from around the world that support them in holding that conversation. And I was delighted when Taylor and Francis saw the publishing company and said, we're publishing this. So now it's available to people all over the world, not just the people initially who knew me.
It's so aligned with our belief. In the ILA Leader 2050 book, I was part of a team of people who wrote about the future of leadership and then developed seven competencies. And one of the seven competencies is intellectually versatile. I can't just work in my very narrow field. I must introduce from other fields to expand my thinking, because I consistently pull from other arenas to solve a problem. It rarely comes only from my very specific arena.
Right. And you need the expertise in that very specific arena that you're great, because that helps hold together and make possible a synergy that wouldn't be possible if we all kind of tried to be the same. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing if I tried to glaze a pot by taking four different glazes and mixing them together in a bowl and pouring it on top of the pot, it would come out bad. Let's just face it. It would come out bad. It wouldn't come out interesting. It wouldn't come out. Okay, so we need each of our unique selves. And part of the Leading Beautifully Award is to inspire people to bring their best, to combine with the best of everybody else, to create that which we have never created before, but we now know is possible.
And I think that's a profound statement. We are solving problems that are emerging as we go along. We must be creating things that haven't existed before. We must be innovating. We must be disrupting to solve the problems that are ever more complex. So it's not just that you won a Lifetime Achievement Award. You're looking at what's next.
Absolutely. And I think in the same way that a lot of really profound thinkers today who work with organizations realize that we need to be responsible for our context, whereas in the past, we just could say, well, the legal, especially in North America, the legal system works, political system works, transportation system. Bad little corners, but overall, it works. And we use that, we rely on that, you know, to maintain contracts, we assume that the banking system is going to work so we can trust each other in terms of payment flows and the rest of that. Okay, today, because we have such huge changes going on, an earthquake of changes, we have to think about what is it that we're doing to support that we'll still have a justice system, that we'll still have a financial system that we can trust, that we'll still have democracies that represent the voice of everybody. We used to think about that as being the public sector, and the private sector was responsible for making things and services and sharing them in a way that, but that's no longer true. The conversation is a little bit more advanced, not enough, around sustainability. But if we think about not just green physical sustainability, but social sustainability.
And for me, that's a big issue. As we look at robotic process automation and artificial intelligence, the World Economic Forum said half of jobs will change in the next 4 years. So that's not somewhere out there when we have jets and flying cars. It's in our five-year planning horizon. Half of jobs will change. A third of the work will change in those jobs. The people who are economically advantaged already, who are highly skilled, they'll get retraining in companies because they're the most valuable workers, and their work will shift. The workers who are on the fringes, especially who are doing more routine tasks, will be replaced with machines in large part. They're the ones who are not getting invested in. So socially, we're going to have a significant social issue, more than we have now, of people who don't have skills and are going to have an increasingly difficult time finding work and don't have the means to get the skills.
I wish I could disagree with you. We know that historically you need a vibrant middle class to have a democracy. You can't have extreme income distribution without a middle class and have democracy, have a stable economy. And second, which I want to come back to, is in the past when there were changes, the question was retraining, and the privileged had much more access to that. Privilege could be because I was born in California. I was born in a very privileged part of the world. I went through a fabulous, at that time, public school system that was competitive with anybody. I graduated from the University of California system, Berkeley and UCLA. Nobody had to be embarrassed to graduate from one of those universities. Mm-hmm. They could be happy that they weren't broke when they graduated, but they didn't have to be. Today, or I'll be nice, 4 years from today, there's no such thing as retraining because everything's continuing to change and change. So the only question is, can we get smarter about learning? And I think it's more the how we learn. If I can outlearn you, I'm going to win. I have to recognize that you might be my best collaborator. I need to recognize that instead of being scared of profound difference is probably where I have the most to learn. One of the things that we work with groups of executives, groups of managers, groups of MBAs, is the people you're going to learn the most from in this organization, in this seminar, in this community, are the people who are most different from you. And yet psychologically, of course, we're most attracted to the people who think like us. So,
well, and physiologically, it's safer to be around people who think like us. We learned in tribal times, you look different than I do, you may be dangerous, right? I'm in a tribe, you're in a tribe. We're migrating around on the plains of the U.S. or wherever. That difference could have been dangerous. I don't know that our brains have changed enough so that we don't see difference yet as danger.
I'm more optimistic on that because we look at many areas where we have changed, and we're currently sitting in Canada where the national belief embedded in our conversations is domestic multiculturalism. It's not melting pot. It's not we all have to be the same in order to not be scary or to be neighbors with each other. It's that we have multiple different people. And it's interesting, my good friend and colleague, who I think you had an opportunity to interview, Henry Mintzberg, Quebec, which is a French-speaking province, was having a referendum on if they were going to leave the rest of Canada or not. So that would have split up Canada. And Henry, as well as myself, was very much for Canada staying together. And Henry got on CBC Radio, CBC TV, and while everybody else was saying, oh, the English and the French can't get along with each other and they don't like each other and they... And there are very different cultural patterns, not just linguistic, between Anglophones and Francophones. But what Henry said is, I ask you, my fellow Quebecois, to go and to turn off your radio, turn off your TV, i.e. stop listening to other people and come back to yourself. Open your window and look outside and ask yourself, do your children play with your neighbor's children? Do your English children play with French? Do your French play with, and with the rest of, we've got Italian and Greek and all sorts of wonderful communities here. Do you work with each other? Do you live with each other? Do you go out with each other? And of course, at a one-on-one level, it was resoundingly yes.
My point is that we can't. My point is it takes us being more conscious. and making a choice for what we want to create against what may have been pre-wired.
And I think it requires that as, and this is a part of leadership, at the individual level, we profoundly come back to our own ability to see the world. We look out at the playground, whether or not you have kids or not, and we see all of these kids from different backgrounds playing with each other. So the minute I let myself see that, then I'm like, well, what's this myth about we can't get along with each other?
So you told a story about traveling to Israel and that we do get along with people when we have a shared purpose. We can, not that it is natural or easy, that we can transcend the differences.
In situations such as the Middle East, where the differences have been embedded in political systems and decisions and at times, that becomes very difficult for most of the population. Although it's quite interesting in the Middle East and in Israel, the parents and especially the mothers who have lost a child are some of the very leaders in bridging across cultures to make things work. My own experience, which was found, which comes from years ago, I had, I was in Israel for the first time. I had an internship with Leah Perot, who was then the Minister of Culture. And it happened to be 1973, which was the Yom Kippur War. And the very first Saturday after the Yom Kippur War broke out, Saturday being Shabbat, the Sabbath, Leah invited me to come with her to Old Jerusalem to Shabbat lunch. And as I arrived, there were 12 people around the table, all very, and half of them were Israeli Jews and half of them were Israeli Arabs. And everybody was animated talking, of course, talking about what was going on, but everybody was listening, everybody was talking about, everybody respected each other. Why was that able to go on is because every single person at that table was an artist, knew the other people, knew of them, if they didn't know them, at that table, and respected their humanity, their families, their... That didn't mean around that table they solved the problems in the Middle East. If that was true, in 1973, we wouldn't be where we are. But it means if we can find a transcendent purpose and if I can see your humanity, not your sameness, but your humanity, and to be able to do that, I need to be able to see. And at least for me, I can't do that through the vocabulary that comes in on the evening news or even the morning news, or even the news on the internet. For me, in order to get that different vision, I need to go back through art, or at least a very different vocabulary that lets me then join with people, see other things, see possibilities that others continue to miss.
And that's the piece I'm calling rewiring our brain, that my default may be, I see you as other. I think what's possible is I see a future where we can bridge those differences. We have to survive on this planet. We have to stop seeing different countries as other and trying to control them to get them to follow our agenda, and they're trying to control us. And we don't have enough resources to continue that dissonance. We have to find paths. What are the ways we can invite one another to see the commonality and the beauty in each one's uniqueness?
Again, art is one of the things that really helps us. Art holds the power to be able to let us know ourselves. If I profoundly know who I am, the fact that you're different doesn't scare me. There was a study done years ago here in Canada that looked at Anglophone, English-speaking Protestants, French-speaking Catholics, English-speaking Jews, French-speaking Jews. And then they looked in all those combinations about both what did you feel about the other, positive, negative, and at behavior. Did you choicefully spend any time meeting with them, getting together, whatever, working with them? To their surprise, the people who were most profoundly religious were more positive towards the other. Because if I'm very, very Catholic, I know I'm Catholic, and the fact that you're Jewish, it's not going to rub off on me and change me because I know who I am. If I'm Protestant, I'm not afraid. It has a deep meaning to me. Mm-hmm. Where we get in trouble, I think, is where we try and pretend, which psychologically we do, that we're all the same or we're completely different. We run into one of those two poles. Neither of those are true. There's a certain level of humanity that we're all the same. And there's a certain levels that are different. And of course, there are outliers who are very negative. But that's not the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And again, art helps us by being a mirror to let us see who we are and therefore allow us to bridge in our teams at work, to bridge in our communities, to bridge in our families.
Nancy, thank you so much. It's been just a pleasure to get to hang out with you for a bit of time.
Thank you.